Hello and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kendrick, and I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Prickett.
Good evening.
And Shane Lees.
Why am I always last? I'm always announced last.
I'm sorry, Shane. I'm genuinely sorry. I'll write a little note here to introduce you first next time.
Hello.
It's definitely not last, but not least.
There we go. That's fine.
Are you well anyway, other than Shane being a bit disappointed he was picked last because, you know, he's a bottom feeder?
Yeah, all was well apart from, you know, that comment.
You all right, Peter?
All fine, thank you, yes.
Good stuff. Just want to start with a few stories that have caught my eye. First of all, thanks to Chris, I found out that Grant Holt is joining Tim Weiser, a former German goalkeeper, in becoming a wrestler. He's appearing in the World Association of Wrestling and combining it with his football commitments. Grant Holt is doing an event in Norwich.
I mean, there's one thing Grant Holt has to his advantage. This is all I understand about WWE, considering the only WWE star I like is Paige, and that's not because of her videos in WWE. What Grant Holt has massively to his advantage is he has a giant penis. No, seriously, does no one remember years and years ago when obviously he was in the Premier League and he did that celebration where he jumped up in the air and his shorts kind of went backwards and the camera got an eyeball? That man is hung like a moose. So if he goes down the same career as Paige, he's going to be doing all right.
I think it's Paige. Paige is involved in this event he's doing. It's her parents or something who are doing the event, if I remember rightly.
Are we sure this isn't a different kind of video?
I got this courtesy of Chris. We'll have to ask him what kind of videos he's been watching.
I've totally derailed this.
Are you a wrestling fan, Peter?
I am, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know that Paige and his family are all from the Norwich area, and they have strong ties and wrestling links. I had no idea about the Grant Holt story. Good luck. He's probably going to be capped, but, you know, anything to get some bums on seats.
Mm-hmm. Should also mention, while we're on the subject of wrestling, Broken But Glorious, they've recently counted down their top 5 wrestling video games. They've also interviewed Chikara star Green Ant about their pay-per-view this weekend.
And don't worry, wrestling fans, I'm not on any of them. You don't have to put up with me.
Moving on from that, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain has bought a Liverpool fan and his 4-year-old son tickets to the Champions League final after seeing that they'd failed to secure one of the 16,000 available seats in the ballot. They've got plane tickets, but weren't able to get the tickets to get into the stadium, unfortunately. A nice gesture, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very nice gesture. It's one of those ones that should have been unnecessary, considering how much they bollocked up the ticket allocations. The fact is, what, about half of the fans are actually going to be fans of the two teams there, and the rest is reserved for general sale. I say that in quotation marks, and sponsorship. That's just bollocks. They really messed that up as far as I'm concerned. I'm not a Liverpool fan, as everyone knows. I do not care about that club in the slightest, but that for both clubs, Liverpool and Real Madrid, it should be 75% at the very least is the supporters of the clubs. Otherwise, it's just a football tourist game. How are you going to get an atmosphere for the biggest and best event in global football? Obviously, aside from World Cup finals and all of that, that's the big showcase. And it's going to be half full of, well, people who are just there for the event, not for the football, not, you know, proper football fans of the teams that are playing.
Are you suggesting that the people who are just there are not going to cheer, or they're just going to sit on their hands and chatter gently?
No, that's not what I'm suggesting. But even you will admit there is a difference between a fan who is like the fan of Liverpool, cheering when they score, being part of that environment, that atmosphere, the songs, all of it, than someone who is not a fan of one of those clubs.
I can tell you, sometimes when I go to a game as a fan, I am utterly paralysed, and there's no singing from me. I'm just sitting there chewing my nails. There's no noise from me. But if I've gone with some friends who don't support the team, they get involved in the songs, they get involved in all that, while I'm just biting and eating my hands.
Yeah, I can understand that, but I think you've got to think as well, surely it's the reward for the clubs that they get to go to these events. Surely it's the award for the fans, they get to go to these events. And if they're saying half of the stadium is going to be full of those fans, I think that's almost kind of taking it away from them. I don't see how that's any kind of acceptable. I can understand them putting stuff on general sale and saying, right, this is going out to more general fans of football. I can understand that. It's the main thing that really gets me is the amount they put out for sponsorships and for, you know, the VIPs and whatever the hell that is. I get that's going to be a number of people, but my God, it's just, I can't agree about it on any level.
Mm. All right, I'm not saying that it's the right thing, but it's the atmosphere. There will be an atmosphere, no doubt about it. The people who go, whether they support the two teams involved or not, they'll get involved. A lot of them will get involved in the songs. They'll make noise. They'll be a part of the atmosphere. Whether who deserves the tickets? Well, who deserves a ticket? Whoever can afford to pay for a ticket. Well, you don't deserve a ticket. You buy a ticket.
Mm. There's 33,000 tickets were given out to Liverpool Real Madrid fans. 7,000 were put on general sale, and the rest are for a mixture of sponsors, the media, etc. So the capacity is 63,000. So it's just over half which have gone to the two clubs, which is, compared to other events we've seen recently, you know, other World Cup finals and Champions League finals, etc., it is quite a big proportion. I must say it's an improving. I do kind of agree with Shane, though, that more, you know, a higher proportion, you know, perhaps 40% to each team, something like that, would be a better allocation.
For me, what I think about is I think about England games. Whenever I watch an England game on, you know, the TV, or I go to an England game, and you've got that massive section which goes out to the sponsors and the, you know, the VIPs or whatever reason they've got to be there. But it's the corporate stuff. It's all about things. And they're always late coming out for first halves, for second halves. They're all sitting down. None of them are really getting involved. And I think, my God, that's what people see. It annoys me to know when that at Wembley, that's where the camera points, straight at that area.
Yeah, that is the solution. Just stick the camera on the other side.
Yeah, but I think it's in general as well. You shouldn't have that amount. It shouldn't be that amount of people, because it's such a major part of the stadium.
It's not actually that many, though. I've been plenty of times. In terms of the percentage of people in the stadium, it's not that many.
Imagine.
And there won't be a problem.
Imagine that number is now roughly a third of the stadium, because that's what the Champions League final is. It's about a third of the stadium is going to corporate.
It's not all corporate. Just said it's not all corporate.
It's a mix.
No, it's 7,000 to general sale and 33,000 roughly, which is going to the actual fans. So it's 40,000 in a 63,000 seat stadium.
It's a mixture.
23,000 out, 60,000 is...
I should say it's a mixture of hospitality members, rights holders, commercial partners, officials, players past and present, and the media.
So bullshit wankers in suits, some journalists who are writing things down, and past and present players. Okay, the past and present players I'm fine with, but I don't think they're going to amount to 1,000 people.
Getting away from this, just want to mention the game itself. Do you think you buy into the sort of media hype that it could be the most attacking Champions League final in a long time?
Liverpool will go for it. They know that they have no option to sit back and try and hope to hold off Real Madrid's attack. They know that's not going to work for them 90 minutes. Real Madrid are a bit like, whenever people are trying to explain how Real Madrid play, they're not an attacking team. Let's get that out of the idea right away. They're not actually an attacking team. They're like Chelsea. They will play whatever way will win them the game. Mm. Real Madrid can be happy to sit back. If they've made a judgment call, which is we can defend better than they can, we need to sit back a little bit, we need to, you know, ease up the pressure, don't play a high line like Roma did and get absolutely slaughtered in the attack, then I think that's what they'll do. But if they're saying to themselves, we can score more than them if we could turn this into a shooting match, then they'll go and attack. I think Real Madrid will play a bit more defensive because they'll see what happened to Roma and say, you cannot be defending halfway up that pitch. It will not work.
Anything could happen in this game. I'm somewhat loath to make any sort of prediction, simply because Liverpool are quite capable of blowing any team that tries to attack them away, and it will depend on what Real Madrid do. Actually, Liverpool have shown that they do have problems when teams say come and break us down. So that would appear to be the way for them to go, for Real Madrid to go, but whether they will, whether that would be acceptable, I don't know. But then Zidane's quite likely to go, to leave or be booted out if they fail to win it. So he's kind of, he can't call it a free hit, but he's got to do it his way. And if it works, they win. He possibly stays on. If it doesn't work, he was probably going to go if they didn't win anyway.
I think you're absolutely right on that one. For Zidane, it's almost a case of he has to win, so he might as well try and go for it. But also, you've got to remember the amount of expectation that's going to be coming to it. Everyone's talking about this being an attack final. Real Madrid are currently talking about this, you know, they're talking about the attacks, they're not talking about the defenders. So they kind of raise the expectations onto themselves that it's going to be this kind of game. And that, of course, that could just be a big double bluff, couldn't it? That could be them trying to gee that all up so Liverpool don't expect a defensive showing and then turn up and then sit at 10 men behind the ball and see what happens. But I don't think it's going to go the way. I think, you look at those Real Madrid players, those aren't just, you know, people talk about them being experienced heads for a final. Yes, but they're also passionate players. Those are players who are deeply passionate. Ramos is not someone you'd describe as disciplined. He's passionate. And when it comes to it, those players are going to want to attack, which is why I do think it will be an attacking game. But Real Madrid have a one team. If anyone can do it to Liverpool, set up shop, counter them, Real Madrid will be better at it than anyone.
It just feels all set up to me for a Ramos last-minute winner. That's my prediction. I think it'll be an exciting game, like a 3-2 Real or something. But
well, my hope is that the Mo Salah story gets the nice ending. But you know, who knows? These stories are lovely, but the reality is that actually, for every player has their own story.
Yeah.
Just waiting to be written. Just because one has been the narrative of a season does not mean it will define the finale, if you like, of the season. So someone's going to have a story out there. We'll all find out soon enough.
Mm-hmm. Joe, who I hope has the story, James Milner. Man, can you imagine it if James Milner is the one who wins the Champions League? How wrong were we of England fans for so many years? He was the key all along.
James Milner's going to get a mention when it comes to talking about the England squad later.
I've raided him for years.
Is he still a penalty taker for Liverpool? Because, you know, I guess that's the way he could become the hero.
It's been shared about this season. Firmino has probably scored more, but I think Salah is actually on them at the moment. Not that Liverpool have actually had that many penalties in the last 4 months.
Okay, we'll move on to the other major final, which happened last week, the FA Cup final. Chelsea beat Man United 1-0 with Hazard scoring a penalty, which was pretty stonewall, with Phil Jones fouling him. What did you guys make of that game?
Awful game. One of the worst cup finals I've ever seen. That is a perfect example of what I think will be the polar opposite of this Champions League final. That was two teams who were too afraid to lose going to play, and it's going to be in a Champions League final two teams who are trying to win. It was just so awful to watch, because I genuinely think the United players didn't realise till about 75 minutes you're losing, and if you lose, you get nothing. It's the final. You don't draw it. You don't win it. It's nothing for you. It seemed to take them so long to wake up. Yes, they started the second half of a bit of them, but that just dried out so quickly when they realised they're not going to get the quick goal against Chelsea. Because Chelsea, on their day, if they want to defend, they're keeping a clean sheet. Any team in the world, if they are on their game, Chelsea will keep a clean sheet. That defence is mighty. When you look at the likes of Azpilicueta and Marcus Alonso, it is such a good defence. And for people saying, you know, neither side deserved to win, I can understand that, but Chelsea were better. But people can say maybe it wasn't as entertaining football from Chelsea as it was from Man United, but they played the game better. They knew what game they were into. They knew how Man United were going to play that game, and they did it better than them. I just think it was such a shame, because we've had some good FA Cup finals over the last couple of years, and normally you get a team who's... Normally you don't have two big clubs like this in the FA Cup final. Normally you've got one who's maybe been massively underperforming for the season or something like that, one who's a bit under it. And this time we got two big teams. That should be, you know, a really big game. The quality should come through and all of that, but it just didn't. It sometimes is a reminder that when you have teams that are that big and they're that balanced, what you actually end up with is terrible games. You almost don't want those. The best games I watch on TV, yeah, when it's just average Premier League games, are the weird ones. They're not, you know, Arsenal versus Tottenham. Those are usually crap games, apart from a few feisty tackles. They're, you know, West Brom versus Liverpool. What a bloody game that was when that one was on. It's the weird games that end up being the great ones. And I think we kind of saw that in practice.
Yeah.
When two cans of paint go to the theatre and it's really boring, afterwards they come out and say, "Phew, that was like watching Man United play Chelsea in the cup final."
I didn't see that coming.
Your comment about it being the worst final you can remember or you've ever seen, I'm trying to think back. The only game I can think of that was as poor to watch as that was, I think, when AC Milan and Juventus drew 0-0 in the Champions League, and it went, I think it was Old Trafford, and it went to pens. And I can't think of another game in recent memory that was such I almost wished I hadn't watched it. I almost wish I'd watched the Royal Wedding instead.
And we're saying that on a football podcast.
It was terrible. I can normally try and drag something of interest out of most games of football, but I struggled. Hazard's run, his touch to set up the run to go and win the penalty was phenomenal.
That was a fantastic through ball as well.
And that's it.
One thing that really annoyed me was how much of an anti-climax it was for the English season. Because you look at how the whole thing went. Man City walked the Premier League. Top four ended up being pretty much everyone, what everyone thought it was going to be. Maybe Chelsea the only exception of that. And then you have the sides who went down for at least two of them. The writing was on the wall for a bloody long time. This Premier League season, as much people go, "Oh, look at all the goals that were scored," and you know, the play City did. If you're not a City fan, you almost don't give a shit about this season. It was just so utterly uneventful. And it was kind of the mouldy cherry on top of the loaf of bread. That's the only way I can really describe it, because it's just kind of been... It's kind of been horrendously boring, really. And that game, it kind of encapsulated that. As good as, you know, the likes of City and Liverpool have been, the great football they've played, how many other clubs in the country can you say have played good football? Interesting football you want to watch. So as a Southampton fan, we bloody well haven't. We haven't got anywhere near that, even when we were, you know, pulling ourselves out of relegation. Burnley may be the only other one, but that's just because what a big surprise they were. It's been a really anticlimactic season for English football.
Watch. Arsenal have been... They had flashes, but yeah, they've been watered down on Arsenal. Then, you know, they're a very poor copy of what they were many years ago. They're still all right to watch sometimes. Leicester, I think, have been an interesting team to watch at times, because they've got two or three players that can really hurt teams. Now, whether they've played great football or not is another story. But do you not think that when a team is dominant in a season, and there's another couple of teams who are pretty good, the rest of the league really suffers?
Yeah.
Because, you know, look how bad the bottom of the table is. Yeah, that's because every time they face a team at the top, they get walloped because of the quality up there. It makes the bottom seem even worse.
It's what we've seen in Germany, in Scotland, in Italy for so many years. At the top, it almost seems to vacuum off a talent and completely destroy the confidence of all the other teams.
Mm.
Yeah, I expect next season, again, we'll have a pretty strong six. There'll be someone who does pretty well from below that and jumps up. And if City are as good as they have been, if United, they've got 80-odd points, so arguably United were pretty good. If the top teams are as strong, you'll see someone stay up with 34 points.
Yeah.
See, the one thing I find, and I say this as someone who is more or less an arch-capitalist, I think that the whole free market thing in football isn't really working. You know, this whole, we've got financial fair play, but that's absolute bollocks, and you can get around it as easily as you want if you try hard enough. But we've got all of this money in football, and the whole thing, everyone's been saying it since, you know, the Sky era, the Premier League era. The whole point of having all this money in football, yes, we're trading off some of the working class roots of the game and some of the passion and the soul of the game, but we're improving the quality, improving the professionalism, we're improving the professional game. That's what the money trade-off is. But the football that's been on show for what, really, if we're talking about the last couple of years, apart from Leicester, it's not been a spectacle. And that's what we've been told we've been supposed to be getting. This money, what we're getting is a spectacle. We're getting an event, we're getting a show. You're paying for something more. When you're paying for your Sky subscription, when you're paying for your match ticket, when you're paying for your membership, you're paying for something more. But are we getting something more?
We're paying for teams to go toe-to-toe.
Yeah, but now what we're really getting is a whole bunch of teams who are too scared to lose. We're getting teams who aren't trying to win because they just don't want to lose so badly. You look at the mid-table, even down to probably 20th, that was probably true of every single club. They were so scared to lose, they weren't trying to win. How many teams this season genuinely weren't trying to win every single game? And of course, the players on the pitch, of course, they want to win, but that's not the same kind of thing. It's this mentality that feeds into it. And that is the total opposite of what this was all supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be raising the quality, which means you raise the viewing spectacle of what football is. And we've had the opposite of that. I think we need to take a genuine look at how we're financing football, how football's being governed, and ask ourselves whether or not this is truly what we were actually paying for, whether or not this trade-off has actually been worth it. And if it's not been, if we're concluding that in general with football fans, we need to start looking at how we can get it back to what it should be, which is a spectacle, which is a show, which is something the fans can buy into, something that they want to be a part of.
Which links back to a team that did finish second without trying to win every game. Because they certainly didn't try and beat City in the first time I played them. And going back, they just lost the cup final. They tried to win the game eventually. And this is the frustration for many. And I know it's been covered a million times, but we can't not mention it. To have that many talented, high-quality footballers and not be entertaining.
It's
awful.
It makes me angry as a United fan, the Martial and Rashford, how much they've regressed under Mourinho this season particularly. He is not the right coach for them. If they were playing, those two players were playing under Guardiola or Klopp or Pochettino, they'd be the main players for their countries this summer in the World Cup. Martial would be in the French World Cup squad. They'd be doing so great. Look at what they've done with Sterling. Look at what Guardiola's done with Sterling, for instance. It just makes me so angry that that they're regressing so much.
As you're a United fan, I'm sure you can understand this much better. When people say, "Oh, United don't have the squad to play like City," yes, they do. They bloody well. Of course, they do have the squad to play like City. What is the point in football if it's not fun? What's the point? Well, are we just, because at that point, if it's not fun, if the fans aren't having fun, if the players aren't having fun, there's only one person who's having fun. Chairmans, the ones who are bringing all that money to watch all that miserable shit on the pitch. They're the only ones who are getting anything from it.
On paper, you look at our four, you know, if you'd have told us a year or two ago, we'd have Pogba, Alexis Sanchez, Lukaku, Mata, you know, as our front players, you know, they're all proven Premier League players, or, you know, Pogba at Juve, you know, other big clubs. On paper, it's the strongest in the league. You know, it could be. I'm sure if Guardiola was United boss, he'd have walked the league there as well. And it does. Yeah. It sickens me that Mourinho is absolutely ruining this club. And, you know, I hate to be the I told you so, Gray, but I did say I never wanted Mourinho there. And this is the end result. And
you're getting to the end of a season talking about Rashford and Martial leaving. I mean, that's just... You're talking about two of the best young players in world football. What on earth? How have they not learned from the years of Chelsea selling the best players and suddenly realising, oh crap, they're better than everyone else? Yeah. Honestly, it's a joke.
I want to move on from this discussion because we'll be doing like an end of season review with awards. Mourinho won't be winning any if I've got anything to say about it. We've got a lot to discuss today with internationals, but I've got to mention Unai Emery coming in as Arsenal boss, who seems to have come in and actually given Arsenal a bit of hope and, you know, a bit of positivity. He's saying about how he's seems success is battling for every title, and that's in his history. There was an 8-man shortlist, and Arsenal said that he was the first pick. Do you think he's the right pick for Arsenal?
I'm amazed with people. There's people out there who are gutted they didn't get Arteta and they got Emery. Mm. I mean, that is astonishing. I mean, the guy is, I think it's 10 major trophies, I think he's won, including. He won the league with PSG. Okay, you should win the league with PSG, as they'll always say with the clubs like that. He won three straight Europa Leagues, UEFA Cups, whatever you want to call them, with Sevilla. Mm. He has got a proven track record.
He's one of the most successful managers in the last 10 years. I mean, there's two points in this. For one, if you're looking for a big manager, looking for a big name who can get you to start winning things, converting things straight away, no one better than Emery they could have got. Ancelotti may be the only other one, but he's not had a good time of late.
I forgot to mention, the only other person who you think could have come straight in, big enough name manager, or huge name manager in Ancelotti's case, get success, it's got to be one of those two.
Yeah, the only thing, and this is where I can understand it, is... with them going for Emery, we know with pretty much absolute certainty he will not be there longer than 5 years. If it goes well, if it goes poorly, he will not be there longer than 5 years. That is an absolute cast iron guarantee, because if it goes well, he's not someone who's going to turn down Barcelona, Real Madrid. He's not someone who's going to turn down one of those big jobs. If it goes poorly, they'll sack him. They won't say, oh, we'll stick with you, we'll try this again. They'll sack him. They've brought him in for success. That's why we didn't go for someone like Arteta. I can understand those Arsenal fans who are now looking at it and going, right, we're now like every other club. We had the 20-odd-year manager beforehand. We had that whole thing of we're being loyal, we're looking long-term, we're bringing through the young players, and now we are just another club, another one of those big clubs who's trying to win something every year, but we'll sack a manager at the first sign of trouble. I can understand why that would grate them, because for me, it's the same thing as United, where after they sacked David Moyes, it was suddenly the acceptance when they brought in Louis van Gaal. We're one of those clubs now. We are not the Sir Alex Ferguson club anymore. We're a different club. And I think it's bruising to identity, I think. So I can understand why there are some Arsenal fans who are pissed off. But at the same time, if they're looking for someone immediately, they couldn't get anyone better than Emery.
But it's also kind of been proven some of that identity was untrue. Particularly the bringing through young players element. Because, you know, for so long, oh, they're full of these potential players. Oh, they'll come good. Well, one's come good this season when he left. And now, unfortunately, Oxlade-Chamberlain's injured. But who of the young players that came through in the last 6, 7, 8 years has actually come through? And been that constant, consistent success. Eventually, Van Persie did, but that, you know, he's pretty much retired. So that's about 10, 12 years ago. Who's come through?
Is there an argument young players who they've signed, like, say, an Aaron Ramsey or someone like that? He's not come through the academy, I accept that, but they've signed him as a, you know, a reasonably young talent, and yeah.
But he's not consistent. He's a goal threat and he can play well, but he's not at the level that the club's supposed to be. But these players that are coming through are supposed to be hitting. I'm sure he could be somewhere else.
Yeah, I agree. It's the same as the likes of Wilshere, could have been, isn't going to be, Bellerin. You know that if he was playing for Barcelona, he would be the best right back in the world right now. We know if he had stuck that one out, he'd be the best right back in the world. We know that. It's just so obvious that Arsenal has completely stunted his growth after a certain point. Yes, there was a point where he was growing at them, but I think he's kind of reached the limit of what that's going to be. He needs to move on somewhere else in order to fulfil that potential. And isn't that just classic Arsenal story?
Maybe under new manager, it could happen for these boys.
Yeah, Emery has got a very good record of taking players who are, yeah, you know, high potential good players but not great players and turning them into some, you know, some really, really good, consistent players. Like
particularly at Sevilla.
Yeah. So I think
Nzonzi being one of those.
Yeah, that's just one hell of a turnaround.
Yeah. Mm. But Blackburn and in the Premier League,
Stoke,
no one thought anything of him and he become a fantastic footballer. And some of that was down to Emery's influence, no doubt.
Mm-hmm. The other big managerial change this week, Pellegrini's coming at West Ham, replacing David Moyes, and Gold has confirmed there'll be some record spending this summer. He's not put a figure on it, but he said it'll be plenty of spending. So could West Ham
heard that before?
Well, does that mean West Ham could be someone to challenge the top six, and be that as we alluded to before? Because he's obviously a proven manager. He's won Premier Leagues. Not saying West Ham will do that, but could they?
I agree with Harry Redknapp on this. Admittedly, I don't agree with how he worded it. He obviously said things about, he can't understand why they brought in an old man who, when there's plenty of other English managers who could have got that job. I do agree with him in sentiment, maybe not exactly what he said, but people saying Pellegrini, he's a successful manager, he's managed big teams. Yes, he has. Real Madrid, it didn't go exactly that well. And Man City, that team, I'm sorry, Sean Dyche could have won the league with that team. Anyone could have won the league with that team. You just need to be someone who wasn't a spaz manager and you could have won the league with that team. What I think is, you look at the likes of Everton this year, they spent a whole bunch of money. Didn't work out at all, did it? It's not just throwing money at it. It's got to be the right money. And you look at that West Ham board, I don't think Pellegrini is going to be put in charge of transfers. That would be crazy to suggest that. And the way he's talking already suggests he's not going to be in charge of transfers. Most modern clubs don't do that. And you look at that board as well. Who are we trusting to go and make those smart transfers? I just think this appointment, he won't be there in 2 years, put it that way. It's one of those ones. It's another one. It's guaranteed to not last, because if he does well, he'll get a better offer and he'll go somewhere else. Or he'll maybe retire on a high. Because he's getting on a bit now. And if he does poorly, they're not going to be patient with him. They'll give him a year and they'll say, right, off you go. I can't understand this kind of appointment. You need to look at what the clubs who are doing consistently well now. I would say Burnley are now one of them. And even though they went down, I'd still say they're doing consistently well, because you look at where that club was before, that even when they went down, they were still improving on what they were. You look at the likes of Bournemouth, you look at all these clubs who are doing well, who are consistently doing well, they have consistent managers, have a consistent way of doing things, consistent style of play. You need to bring in someone who's going to do that, even if it's not going to be someone who's going to be there for 4 years, 5 years, so on. You need to bring in someone who's going to set out for someone else, who's going to bring it there to carry it on. That's not Pellegrini. Mm-hmm. So what are West Ham doing? What are they just going to try and every 2 years have another refresh of the squad, spend another 100 million, give it a go to maybe get Europa League? What's the point? What's the point? Try something. Try and build something. West Ham have this whole... Their fans love this whole concept of identity. They will love it if someone comes in and tries that. Even if they fail, they will love it if someone comes in to try it. They love Bilic for it, and yes, it went wrong in the end, and I think what really went badly for Bilic was his mentality dipped completely, and they realised he no longer bought into that identity, and that's what went wrong for him. But they will love it if someone comes in and tries. That's not what they've just done. They've appointed someone who is obviously a short-term fix. They need something long-term, because with the stadium difficulties, with the fan troubles at the moment, short-term isn't going to cut it. It's not going to work. They need proper long-term investment of money, for one thing. It's not going to be, we're going to spend a bunch of money in this transfer window. Look at the young players. What was the last big young player who came out of West Ham? And that's West Ham. That's what they were always known for. They were one of the big clubs in England for that. They need to get back to roots, get back to doing things long term, and that will build up a club. But obviously the board there do not have that mentality. They are not, they're not football people, so they don't understand this, and they don't understand that the fans aren't demanding they spend 150 million. The fans are demanding that West Ham be West Ham. Mm. That's a totally different thing, and I think they've completely misread the situation. I don't see this ending well.
Okay.
Canary Wharf FC. Yeah, well, that's kind of what it is, isn't it? It's that someone took something from the East End of London and tried to polish it up and make it look nice, and they're hoping it eventually gets there. One thing I was looking at when was with Pellegrini was he does seem to have been almost a symbol of ambition for clubs. When he had a great spell at Villarreal, was when we first started to hear of him. He did help. He had one Roman Riquelme prompting the team, but he got the best out of Diego Forlan. Mm. And it was under Pellegrini that Forlan flourished and became a top quality player, the player that United had hoped he would be. Then when he went to Real Madrid, he went there the same time they spent the 80 million on Ronaldo. So he seems to have been a bit of a symbol of ambition. When Malaga got some money, they appointed Pellegrini, and he did okay. But that is the past. This is now. We shouldn't discount what someone has done previously. It's just it becomes a bit of a gamble when they haven't done anything for a while. Mm-hmm. It could go either way. I mean, it could be excellent. Pellegrini's teams have always played attacking, exciting football, and he could go for that. And West Ham do that. Do they have the technically gifted players to do it or not? Don't know. Recruitment will be important. But it could be in attempting to play in that way, the wheels just fall off.
Mm. Yeah, I think no one can argue that Pellegrini isn't a good manager. Admittedly, I do think it's a little bit worrying that he decided to go off to China for the last 2 years. Clearly not the sign of someone who's got his head right. Clearly not the sign of someone who's looking at the football side of things. That's looking at money. That's someone who's maybe not got their priorities right. And after he was successful with City, I think you almost kind of... I do kind of think he's in the winter of his career now. I think he's had his success, and this is kind of like the last few tailing off bits, which are almost never a good sign for a manager when they're in that position. But I just... For me, it's almost like irrelevant if they do well out of this. Because what West Ham need is repairing. They need healing, and a short-term thing will never do that. If you get your leg cut off, you can cauterize the wound, you can go on, and you can try and cover up and stop the bleeding out. Eventually, you've got to do long-term surgery and therapy. Eventually, you've got to do that, because that's the only way you ever actually properly heal. And that's what West Ham need. They don't need the short-term thing. That was supposed to be what these last two seasons were about. That was the short-term thing. Mm. Get through the stadium move. What they need to do now is something long-term. And what they basically said in appointing Pellegrini is it's 2 more years at least of short-term. And how long does that keep going? Do they just point someone else for short-term, someone else for short-term? It's not what the club needs. This club is in real danger, I think. And it's not because of relegation or anything like that. It's the disconnect between the fans and the club. And that's, I don't see that getting better with the likes of Pellegrini.
Okay, I'm a bit more optimistic about Pellegrini coming in myself. Yeah, I don't know, I can see West Ham challenging. I thought at the time it was a bit harsh of them to sack David Moyes, but with Pellegrini coming in, I'm a bit more confident. I do sort of agree, though, that they should maybe be looking a bit more long-term. It's, yeah, but I don't know, I got a feeling next season West Ham will do well.
They could emerge from the pack, as the phrase goes, to be that 7th or 8th place team that do quite well because they've got a manager who can play, get a team to play a particular style of football that will be good to watch. But he needs quality to do it. Yeah. I'm not sure how much quality they have. I think they've got two quality players, and that's it. And that's Arnautovic and Lanzini. Whether they'll keep... Lanzini's been linked lots with other clubs. I mean, the Monday, or it might have even been Sunday, straight after the last game, West Ham fans were playing, well, Lanzini's going, he's going to Liverpool. He'll be at Liverpool in a day or two. They don't think they're going to keep him. And where they find other quality players, it's such a tough market without spending huge amounts of money. Don't know. He's got to have good enough players to play in that style that could be a success. Not that that's much different to other clubs, really. Because in the end, everyone needs quality players.
Okay, I just want to move on from the domestic stuff and finish the show by talking about the internationals, the World Cup. First of all, we'll go on to the exciting topic, that's England. Don't know if we'll all agree or not. So the 23 has been selected, just for those of you who have been living under a rock. It's Butland, Pickford, Pope, Alexander-Arnold, Cahill, Delph, Jones, Maguire, Rose, Stones, Trippier, Walker, Young, Dele Alli, Dyer, Henderson, Lingard, Loftus-Cheek, Kane, Rashford, Sterling, Vardy and Welbeck. All in agreement with that squad or not?
No.
What do you disagree with, Peter?
Let's start with the choice of Manchester United central defender. For me, he's taken the wrong one.
Presumably Smalling, you...
I would have taken Smalling ahead of Jones. Personally, I just think Smalling is the better defender, the better player. And Jones brilliantly showed himself during the cup final. Someone said recently, if you're going to play Wembley, play your greatest hits. And Phil Jones showed his greatest hits because that was... exactly him in a nutshell. Pacey player, takes him on, he tries manfully to stop it and is just incapable of doing so. I think Smalling's a better defender and I would have taken him.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'll give Southgate some credit. There are some decisions he's made there which I think are very good ones. Not taking Wilshere, for me, that's a great decision. Not taking Lallana, again, for me, that's a very good decision. We're talking about players who haven't played enough, you cannot count to be fit for that World Cup. Good decisions there. I like, he's tried to be ambitious. I can see what he's tried to do here. He's tried to go for a younger team. He's tried to go for something that, you know, where we can play a bit of football. We can actually try and do something. I can get what he's gone for here. But what I look at in that team is a team that is grossly unbalanced. We have called up two central midfielders, in a team of 23. There are only two natural central midfielders in there. And we're talking about it because we've got to be playing five at the back with this team. You look at how many defenders we're taking. We have got to be playing five at the back, which means our two central midfielders are going to be sitting deep, which is going to be Eric Dyer and Jordan Henderson. We have not got a single other player who can play in that position in that entire team. Not one. The closest you've got to are Fabian Delph, who hasn't played that position in over a year, and didn't really play that position beforehand. Loftus-Cheek, who's an attacking player, and Dele Alli, who's an attacking player, with no other central midfielders. That seems mental to me, considering we've decided we need three left-backs and three right-backs. I look at it as well, and I think, you look at what we've done wrong in previous tournaments, and people can talk about picking form players or picking players by reputation. That, for me, it doesn't really matter too much. Look at what other nations do successfully, and what the difference between what we do. What we do is we pick a bunch of players and sellotape them together. I'm saying we've got to be playing five at the back, but God knows what kind of formation we're going to be playing. God knows what kind of approach we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing counter-attacking. We're going to be doing possession. We're going to be attacking. No one knows. No one has any idea because nothing's been put together in these last, since Southgate's been in charge. Nothing's been put together. And the fact it seems like so much of this is a surprise in the way we're doing it and in the way we balance that team. We aren't going in there with a very clear idea of exactly how we're going to play. Those players aren't going to be going in there with that clear idea. Southgate might do. I feel like he's probably the only one who really knows about that, though. I don't feel like those players are going to go onto the pitch with some cohesive idea of this is what England football is, this is what we are at this tournament. It just looks to me like another sellotape together squad. And I think the only team who can do that and win is Italy. They are the only bloody team who can ever do that and win because they're the bloody Italians. We can't do that. We've shown no record of being able to do that.
Can I just ask on the central midfielders, you say, you know, we'll probably need another midfielder in the squad. Who would you have picked who he didn't pick?
even if you're just making up the numbers, put in Jake Livermore. I don't rate Jake Livermore. I don't think he's a great central midfielder. But we need more than one. What happens if first game Jordan Henderson picks up an injury? If we're screwed. We're screwed if Jordan Henderson picks up an injury in game one. Raya picks up an injury. That's mental.
I actually would have taken Wilshere. He's started 29 games this season, which is more than, which when I looked that up was more than I expected. He started more games than Loftus-Cheek. He's started more games than, I know Danny Welbeck doesn't play in midfield, but Welbeck has snuck in this squad, which I think is another one I wouldn't have taken Welbeck. But Jack Wilshere has actually started 29 games this season. And if another central midfielder, the dearth of options, I would have taken him.
Thing is, Wilshere, though, like, you look at his reaction to being left out of that squad, that shows his mentality. He's not a team player. He's not a team player. You don't take the Mavericks unless they're bloody Ronaldo. You can't afford them at an international tournament. I mean, who was... I cannot remember who it was. I think it may have been one of the Spain players. I think it was Herrera? I can't remember. One of these players, they got left out and they basically just said, good luck, guys. That was their whole... I've been left out. Good luck, guys.
Morata,
that was it. Yeah, he just turned around and said, good luck. Of course he's going to be pissed off. Of course he's going to be disappointed. He didn't make a big thing of it. I can understand why I've been left out of that squad. I've not had a great season. I can understand why I'm out of it. You can tell that was his mentality. Wilshere doesn't have that mentality. For me, he shouldn't be part of that squad because he just seems toxic. But I have to say, Welbeck, I disagree with. Yes, I can say on the basis of this season, he's not been great, and I would have liked to have seen us take a try on Sessegnon, but Danny Welbeck has never let England down in England shirt.
Neither's
always put in a good performance.
Neither's Wilshere. He's got many man of the match performances for England.
It's different though. It's a certain level of professionalism. It's a certain level of disruption as part of that team that you have to take that into account for. I have to say Phil Jones, I do think he's been a very good defender this year. He's one of those defenders, a little bit like Gary Cahill. He has bad moments, and those moments make everything look a hell of a lot worse. The other one, which I know I'm going to get disagreed with on this one, Joe Hart should have gone. I know he's not had a good season. I know he is probably not England's top three goalkeepers anymore. We picked three England goalkeepers with no tournament experience. I think you need someone at least as the third choice to be able to advise those guys on what's going to happen, what it's going to be like, because none of those keepers can talk to each other and say, this is what an England tournament's like. None of them can be giving that confidence of being a senior player, and that is such a big thing. That is a huge thing. So we're sending some of those players out for their first tournament caps, and there's no one they can turn to other than the coaches, and that's not the same kind of relationship. So as much as, you know, Nick Pope definitely deserves to be there, Jordan Pickford deserves to be there, I don't see anything Jack Butland's done this season that makes him worthy of being there. But yeah, I can see that he's maybe a better keeper currently than Joe Hart, but I think on the basis of the experience, you say you're there and you're there to make sure this next generation of England keepers is going to be better than the last. That's what you're telling his role is.
No, in terms of goalkeeper, I don't care who the number three is. I don't care who the number two is, as long as you get your number one right. Best doesn't really matter. You can take Peter Shilton as your number three if you want.
Yep.
As long as you get that number one right. And at the moment, I think Jordan Pickford is quite a long way ahead. Whether he is bang in form is another story, but he's a long way in front. He's number one. Take whoever else you want.
Go on. Oh, yeah. I was going to say, personally, I really like Nick Pope. Jordan Pickford has got very good distribution, but I like how dominant Pope is in the air and how commanding of his defence is. That's just a personal preference on types of keepers. Jordan Pickford, if it's between one of them two for starting, either way I'm happy, as long as it's not Butland. He's done nothing to justify it, other than apparently being a great keeper.
You see, the general consensus to me, or from what I see anyway, appears to be that it's close between Pickford and Butland, with Pope the clear third choice. I think Pickford will probably get the nod because of his distribution, which is an important element of this team which Southgate's trying to build, and that's probably why Jones got the nod over Smalling, because while Smalling is a very good defender, his distribution, his passing is not up to scratch, which is fine for United but isn't fine for the system England want to play.
Yeah, I don't think either of them's passing is particularly good, which is a bit of a problem.
Jones's is better in my humble opinion, but anyway.
It's not a lot in it either. I'm glad Trent Alexander-Arnold's in the squad.
Mm-hmm.
He might even play as the right-sided player. If he does, I'm sure he'll do fine. Possibly slightly more creative than Trippier, but Trippier has a good quality of delivery. Kyle Walker is going to be playing as a right-sided centre-back. It's the composition of the squad telegraphs that. Now, he's tried to be adventurous in some of his selections, like the Loftus-Cheek selection is surely supposed to be an adventurous selection looking towards youth.
Mm.
If he's going to do that, could he have called up Ademola Lookman? He's had a superb time in Germany at Leipzig.
Mm.
He scored 5 goals in 11 games, and he has looked an exciting prospect. If we're going to go for excitement and give youth its chance, maybe we could have looked at Lookman. so even more adventurous, Jadon Sancho has had a very good end to the season. Now, these are players with no international experience at the moment, but
I think it links back to what I was saying about identity. If we go there and we're taking this really young, adventurous squad, then it's clear that we're going to be a bit attacking, we're going to be a bit cavalier, and we're going to be trying to build something for the future. That's the identity. We suddenly know that straight away. You look at that squad and you go, identity, what is it? You can't identify this squad as being anything in particular other than a sellotape-together group of 23 players. It's a group of 23 players. It's not an England team, if that makes sense. But the big one, I think we've all missed out on saying something about, is the left-back who should be starting who is not even in the squad, Ryan Bertrand. Okay, he's not had the best of seasons, but he's actually probably been one of Southampton's best players. And Danny Rose has played, what is it, something like 9 games? He's been crap for most of them.
Mm.
And his head's been missing the entire season. Okay, Ashley Young, I can totally get that. I'd have had him being number 2 at left back. Fabian Delph, I can get if you're going for a utility player. Can kind of make sense. Danny Rose makes no sense. Bertrand is a better left back than him. He's played more this season, been more consistent over the last couple of seasons. That makes no sense to me on any level. That's got to be a spot for the boys.
I would have taken Bertrand, but I would have taken him instead of Delph rather than instead of Danny Rose.
Mm.
It's weird. This is where you kind of get double standards start to come up because he's picked Rose, as you said, jobs for the boys. But another way of saying that is a player who he's worked with before and trusts.
Mm.
And he's not going to be playing left back. He's going to be playing left wing back, which Ryan Bertrand is perfectly capable of doing as well,
and done it all season.
Yeah, and Fabian Delph, it's an international tournament. I don't think we particularly need a right-footed left wing back who can't beat his man on the outside. Hang on, I'm starting to talk about Ashley Young.
I like Ashley. I think Ashley Young's had a great season for United. I also think Delph has been good for City, and both of them being versatile. Young can play on the right if necessary, or even as a winger. And Delph in centre mid, I'd have taken both, but I completely agree with Shane that Bertrand should have gone instead of Danny Rose. 100%.
This is one of the things that's annoyed me about this election, is Southgate has been completely inconsistent, and he's also been a massive hypocrite. He's turned around to Adam Lallana and said, you can't be in the squad, you've not played enough, and Danny Rose is in the squad. He's turned around to Joe Hart and basically he said, you've not been good enough, and Jack Butland's in the squad. That baffles me. He's gone down and he's been crap. Jack Butland is Fraser Forster Mark II. Can do nothing as a goalkeeper. No one can ever explain to me why he's a good goalkeeper, and no one can, other than he's a good shot stopper, which every single professional goalkeeper is a good shot stopper. Even Sven Ulreich and his abysmal showing in the Champions League, they're all good shot stoppers, okay? That is like the minimum you've got to have. It's absolute rank hypocrisy, because he's been saying, you know, oh, Ryan Bertrand, you've maybe not been good enough this season, and then Danny Welbeck's in the squad. We can't go for some of the older players, but Gary Cahill, you're fine. What is the consistency? It's like you've said, if we're going for the younger players, call up some of the younger players, have that be the consistency. There's no, oh, we're playing this style of football because we pick players from all these teams who play this style of football. Oh, we're going for this approach with younger players because we want to bring in a new thing. Or, oh, we're going for experience so we can have experienced heads and we can try and do an Italy at a tournament. We've got no particular thing we're trying to do, which is why I keep going back to this thing of sellotaping a squad together, and it doesn't bloody work. Mm. It's never worked. Why are we doing that? Why people talk about, oh, we go for form, or, oh, we go for players who are well known. That doesn't matter. It's probably not we go for something which has some form of identity, some form of all those players know what they're doing, what position they're going to be playing, how they're going to be playing the second they're called up. They don't. I guarantee you that. They don't.
You should be able to look at it and see how the pieces fit together. Mm. We can see that. We can see that it's going to be free at the back and with wing backs and Harry Kane up front. And then you just chuck the rest of the bits in. Yeah. It's probably going to be Dele Alli and Raheem Sterling playing off of Kane with Henderson and Dier as the two midfield players, possibly Rashford coming on for Sterling after Raheem Sterling has tried to shoot with immense power and trickled one through the goalkeeper or miscontrolled the ball for the sixth or seventh time, because that's what he does in an England shirt. But beyond that, what else is there? That's, we sort of get an 11 out of that. Mm. But then where do players come in? Where's the cover? Could we have actually taken Lewis Cook rather than left him as a reserve? Mm-hmm. I think we probably could have done, you know?
See, I think it's ironic that we've got Gareth Southgate, who's the former England under-21 manager, who hasn't learned the lessons of why we've been so successful at youth football. Because we haven't just been sellotaping a team together. Those teams have gone out there with a style of play. They've gone out there with an identity, and we've been very successful at a youth level. There's always been an approach, and it's clear. And I will give the FA its limited bloody credit of they are starting to maybe put something together with the youth teams. Because they're starting to realise that's the important thing. But then if it doesn't filter through to the senior team at any point, it's pointless. It doesn't make any damn bit of difference. Won't work.
This was the problem with the first of all, it was the future game that they released, which was supposedly a playing style that was promoting open, expansive football. And then they appointed Roy Hodgson. So you immediately had a manager in charge of the top side in the country that wasn't adhering to what was going on beneath. Then in came Sam Allardyce, and at that point England were releasing the DNA, which was this, again, a playing style that is what they have used at youth levels, which is what has made all these achievements, and totally contrasted with Sam Allardyce's style, which is why the appointment of Southgate made sense, because he knows and understands the England DNA, the way that the teams are playing, the style that's supposed to be involved, can we attack with six players? Can we get the ball over the halfway line in six passes? Can we regain possession within 6 seconds? This was a Dan Nitucci rule, which has been used and been immensely successful. The problem is these players are not ready yet. They were ready for youth football. They're not ready for international football because they are barely playing club football. And this argument will go on in perpetuity. Mm. They've got to make their breakthrough. And this is where the moving abroad could be where all the answers lie, because Lookman, Sancho and the others who are starting to play overseas, they're getting their experience. Mm. And they will be ready, and there'll be more options with these players who have come through with the identity that you're talking about, Shane, and has been missing.
And I can understand when people say, oh, we haven't got a great squad at the moment, we're really limited on central midfield, all of that kind of stuff. But we've been in transition since 1996. as an England team. Can't be in transition forever. Eventually you've got to transition into the bloody thing you were trying to transition to. Why isn't... I know we've got limited players, but sides with limited teams have won competitions for, or they've at least had some kind of semblance of what they are as a team. How is it that we are both non-competitive and have no identity? How can we have both of those situations? Tunisia have a bloody identity, solid team unit, team play, all about a good team cohesion. That's their identity. Costa Rica had that. Iceland had that. Small teams, teams that aren't competitive, at least knew what they were bloody well about. How have we, as England, with the amount of quality and just the amount of money that is pumped into our game, and there is not a single country on earth, we're both at grassroots level, all of that, there is nowhere where they're putting more money in football than us. How, of all of that, do we still have nothing to show for it? This whole idea, we're in transition, we're limited. We shouldn't bloody be limited. We shouldn't have a limited squad. We shouldn't be in this situation at all. And as much as you can't blame Southgate for some of those things, it's all part of it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And we can't turn up to every tournament losing, just saying, oh, the manager's bad, and oh, and we need to sort out youth and all of that. Like, we need to actually almost start again and just think, bloody hell, how have we convoluted and complicated this so badly that small, tiny crap teams can figure this out quicker than we can? It's honestly, it's just, we're making the same mistakes every time. And when we go out there in the round of 16, we'll be saying all the same things again. And how many more tournaments do we have to do that until we actually appoint some fucking football people in charge of this country? Jesus.
Well, good luck, England, for the World Cup. I'm sure we'll all be behind the lads when it comes to the game. I'm sure, Shane, you'll be supporting England.
Oh, I'll be going mental. I'll be in the pub for every single game. I love England. That's the problem. It's the same as all those other people who, you know, moan. It's because we love English football and we don't want to see it being as pointless as it is. There's so much apathy around the English game at the moment. That's not without reason.
Okay, just as a final question then, how far do you think England will get in the World Cup?
I think we'll struggle a lot more than we think in the groups. I think round of 16. Peter? But I think we'll scrape through in the groups.
They're bankers to win it, right?
You've been reading The Sun?
Never. I believe England are 20. Well, England are 16-1. England are shorter priced than Portugal, which is bizarre to me. It's weird now because when Sven was in charge, quarterfinals weren't good enough. I'll tell you what, I'll take a quarterfinal now.
Yeah, I hope.
England have got three or four very good players who, if they are on form during the tournament, could see them do well. You don't need a great squad or a great 1-11 to win an international tournament. You need to be relatively steady and have two or three players who are at that level. And they have got two or three who could do that. So if they click, that is where the possibility for, well, something that we can't imagine or have been unable to imagine during this podcast could happen. But it's a, if is, as I believe Sir Bobby Robson said, the biggest two-letter word in football. They could click together and produce something. On the other hand, absolutely nought could come of it.
All right, well, I think we'll end the show on that positive note. I'm looking forward to the World Cup this summer, even if England do disappoint. You can check out our wrestling show, as I mentioned before, Broken But Glorious, and also Perfect Formula, which is our F1 podcast. And follow us on Twitter at V2 Sport Network. It's goodbye from me and goodbye from my guests, Peter Prickett and Shane Lees. Goodbye.
Goodbye.